The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, the nation's report card shows a drop in average scores for 8th graders in science and for 12th graders in math and reading. And liberal arts colleges are going through a challenging time, but one private college in Massachusetts is reimagining education. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. The latest National Assessment of Education Progress, perhaps better known as the nation's report card, shows a drop in average scores for 8th graders in science and for 12th graders in math and reading. The 2024 results were released on September 9th by the National Center for Education Statistics. They also mark the first post-pandemic NAEP scores for each assessment. The numbers show continued declines in proficiency among American students. Lucas Willard spoke with Dr. Benjamin Solomon, an associate professor at the University at Albany School of Education, to ask what he thought of the latest numbers.
It's not good. So, you know, the test is given at 4th, 8th, and 12th grade. It's given every 2 years to 4th and 8th grade in reading and math, and then I believe every 4 years to 12th graders. So this is the second one, I believe, for 4th and 8th graders since the pandemic, but the first one since the pandemic for our 12th graders. And what it has shown is slightly different patterns in reading and math. For reading, scores have largely stagnated since the pandemic. Just persistently low scores, with those that are sort of in the 75th or 90th percentile holding their own, but those below gradually falling. And if you look at it, the proficiency rate in 12th grade, which you mentioned, is pretty low. I don't quote me on this, but I think it's in the 30s. I think around 35% ballpark. For math, we see a slightly different pattern where scores were slowly ticking up pretty much until the pandemic. But then there was a clear drop as students, were pushed out of school, pushed into remote learning. And then in 22, we saw a slight uptick for our higher kids, but a stagnation on our lower kids. And then in the most recent one, that stagnation persisted. So we're still below, significantly below pandemic level achievement for math. 12th graders were also, I believe, assessed in science this year. And there was significant concerns there. Pretty low scores. Gender gaps between male and female students, which were emerging. And overall low achievement that that is below, prior levels. So overall, it's a pretty concerning picture.
There's also a preparedness score that's given to 12th graders. So yeah. Are these students prepared to go to college? And I just want to point out that the most recent report says that 35% of 12th graders are prepared to go to college in reading. And that's down from 37%. From 2019. So you had mentioned the pandemic, and a lot of people, maybe I'm generalizing, but there's a lot of finger pointing to the pandemic to say this is the great disruptor, and this now we're still seeing the consequences of that. But as you have pointed out, and what the numbers have shown is that there's been a decline for a while now. But when it comes to the pandemic, what's your assessment, and maybe what do the numbers say of how students are faring? Was there a exacerbation of those numbers because of the pandemic? Did it accelerate declines that were already in the works?
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic certainly had an effect. And it would make sense because in reading, we saw sort of a stagnation. But students get some level of incidental reading exposure in and out of school, right? There's text all around us. So it makes sense that the pandemic had less of an effect on reading than it did in math. Students tend to only get math in one place, school. And we've learned remote learning is not really terribly effective, especially for our at-risk learners and especially for our younger kiddos. So that makes sense why we saw a bit more of a crash in math. But I think it's incorrect to say that the pandemic was the sole reason that we saw those suppressed scores. As you mentioned, especially for our at-risk learners before the pandemic, but after the pandemic, sort of for a much greater population of students, there's a lot of factors that play into that, actually. You know, aside from the pandemic, I think we can look to just the socio-political context. There is rising disproportionality, for example, in socioeconomic status between the rich and the poor. And I think it would be, you know, foolhardy to say that didn't have something to do with it, because it trickles into our schools in terms of students' needs and in terms of how those schools are funded. Another huge element of it, which I think is important and which is quite changeable, is the curriculum and instruction that these students receive. There's been a lot of attention paid to that recently, and that's an independent variable that's separate from the pandemic.
The science of reading, as one example, has been a focus. We're in New York State, where it's been something that's been included in legislation in the state budget, and there's been a big focus on the science of reading. But this is not the only state where that's occurring. There are a lot of states that are looking at reading fundamentals as something to invest in right now. One, what do you think of this approach? And two, how long of a ramp up could there actually be for focusing on the fundamentals and therefore having a positive effect on these assessment scores with more students being able to read more proficiently?
Yeah, the science of reading was a crucial turning point in our reading instruction. We'll call it literacy instruction because it's broader than just reading. Our literacy instruction across the country. Of course, there's Emily Hanford's podcast, which sort of sold the story, which caused a bit of a tipping point. At the same time, the Reading League emerged in Syracuse, and we also had states starting to pilot specific models. You know, for example, Mississippi is often brought up as being one of the first to hold on to the science of reading and then show meaningful gains in their student population because of it. In New York, admittedly, we're a little bit behind the curve on that, whereas other states, I think, were getting on that, a couple years ago. Only recently did New York release sort of a science of reading initiative, and it was broader than other states in terms of what they're expecting of schools. They provided a framework, sort of hit touch points, if you will, for what schools should be focusing on, but they didn't provide, at least at a state level, there was no real sort of, as I understood it, plan to vet specific curriculums, really operationally define specific areas of reading that schools must focus on and how they must demonstrate that they're focusing on those areas. So we absolutely did acknowledge the science of reading in New York, but it's a little hazier than has been sort of institutionalized in other states. And that's promising, but I think it's also a little concerning because I think when you look at what variables lead to change with schools, you need very specific directions. You need crystal clear directions because otherwise things get lost in translation. And geez, it's hard to be a teacher these days, right? you get so many different voices coming at you from in both ears. So you really need specific expectations that the school can help train up on. I'm not convinced we're there yet in New York. So I hope whatever we've done in New York, I hope it does reflect in upcoming scores, but I'm not convinced it will yet.
There are states right now that are discussing cell phone bans in the classroom. New York has just implemented its first bell-to-bell ban on smartphones and internet-connected devices for K-12 students. Do you think that restrictions on technology are going to have an effect in how students perform academically?
Yes. You know, you're a little outside my area of expertise, but intuitively, I see no reason a cell phone ban, sorry for the double negative, isn't a good idea. Yeah, I think it makes sense. I think if you look at the research, and again, it's not my area, but you see a heavy level of distractibility, you see effects on social-emotional health among students. You know, cell phones are, by design, addictive. And, you know, especially for a middle school or adolescent, that's particularly enticing. So I think it is a good idea to have a cell phone ban. Although, again, I don't want to take attention away from the critical importance of curriculum and having high quality curriculums that align with the science of reading in schools. Both of those things, at the least, are important.
And Benjamin, do you teach classes at UAlbany?
Yeah.
So have you noticed any performance drops or issues with the students that you teach who are coming through over the years?
No, I haven't. I'm very proud of my students. They do a great job. I work with graduate students, for what it's worth, in school psychology. So they're sort of a self-selected bunch, right? They've been admitted into grad school. We have a competitive program. In my very narrow case, I don't see a particular concern. But again, I work with a self-selected population.
So in addition to, we just talked about the science of reading, but where, from your experience and from your analysis, do you feel is the most important area or areas to support education through public funding? Where are the choke points, if you will? What should be the focus from leaders at the state or in the federal government to ensure that reading proficiency, academic proficiency, math is science, that students are performing where they should be? That's a big, broad question, but take it where you will.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot of critically important areas. I don't want to belittle any specific area, whether it be in the academic or behavioral, or social, emotional health, or physical health areas. They're all quite important. And there's different initiatives that can contribute to each one of those that can contribute to student health success. But as far as specific academics go, in the state, I do think we need a more clear direction, and funding can contribute to professional development that's pretty persistent and pretty in-depth, that focuses on the simple view of reading, that focuses on the tenets of the science of reading, both in the, in the phonics and letter sound correspondence domain and in the language comprehension domain. I think teachers are still a little confused on average. Obviously, there are some excellent teachers in New York as to what that looks like. You can't just tell them, you have to model it, and you need funding to develop those resources. So that would be pretty important to me. And I think we need to put groups together to make a greater focus on specific curriculums that have been shown to work. And again, connect that to teachers. Don't speak at them. Model it and provide supports in schools. And I think that will pay dividends. A similar picture for math, which is actually my area of focus. There's been, we talk about the reading wars, but there are math wars too. And there's huge controversy in terms of how we should teach math. And there is an emerging science of math, and which frankly doesn't align, in my opinion, with what our standards are in New York. For example, if you look in New York, very few third graders probably emerge with their multiplication tables memorized. But that's very important. They need to memorize their multiplication table because that contributes to pre-algebra and algebra and geometry and so forth. And so I think we actually need to put a huge amount of work into a parallel model for math, where we sort of define what a good curriculum in math looks like, what its features are, and we provide sort of a lot of publicly accessible teacher resources and training to insert good activities, good exercises into our classrooms in math to really build that skill up. Because again, reading is critically important, but a number of students will learn to read regardless of instructional technique because literacy surrounds us. That is not the case necessarily in math. Most students only have access to math. I mean, some students who, privileged students, have parents that are engineers or scientists and they get it all the time. But school is the only place a lot of students have access to math. So if they're not given excellent instruction in math in schools, then they simply don't get it. And that's why we also see, if you look at the NAEP scores, proficiency rates slowly sort of erode over time from 4th to 8th to 12th grade, because the gaps are very small in 4th grade, but then they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And if you're a student of a wealthier family, you'll self-insure and get tutoring to close that gap. But if you're not, you're going to fall further and further behind. So instruction in math is particularly important, and we're pretty far off the mark nationally in terms of making that sort of a an everyday practice.
Do you think that any cuts to the Federal Department of Education will have a ripple effect in how students learn? Now, I know that federal education dollars support a lot of Head Start programs, special education programs. It's not necessarily curriculum that we're talking about here, but it's support to programs that ultimately do benefit students. So do you have any predictions of how the possible elimination of the federal Department of Education will have an effect here?
So it's sort of hazy at the moment, right? Because the cuts came very quickly and in a huge volume. And so it's unclear sort of in 2 years where we'll be as an effect on the cuts. But generally speaking, I am concerned. Yes. Because the funding goes to multiple areas, as you just noted. But, you know, two main areas. One, as you pointed out, services to students, especially students historically have been underserved. A lot of their funding often came from those federal grants, whether it be, American Indian populations or, urban populations of children in poverty. A lot of their fundings came from those federal funds, and they got the rug pulled out from under them. And, I can't, at the very least, I can't imagine that has any benefit at all. So I think we're all bracing for what the degree of the negative will be. Another critical area as those funds went to was, of course, cutting edge research in educational techniques and content. For example, the Institute for Educational Sciences, IAS, which I believe sponsors, is involved with NAEP. So, you know, they were pushing out a lot of very competitive grant competitions to investigate which educational techniques work best for students of various demographics. A lot of those studies were in a very advanced stage. You know, some of them had been going, you know, 5, 6, 7 or more years through multiple phases of funding, through scaling up projects, through rigorous feedback with their federal contacts. And some of them were on the cusp of putting out some pretty important findings in terms of what teachers should be doing in schools, what administrators should be doing in schools, and it just got all lost. So again, understanding the exact penalty is hard, but intuitively we can say it's not good.
Benjamin Solomon, thank you so much for taking the time. Appreciate
thank
it.
You. It was a privilege.
Benjamin Solomon is an associate professor at the University at Albany School of Education. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Lucas Willard. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. In a challenging time for liberal arts colleges, when attitudes toward higher education are changing amid a shift in what employers are seeking, one private college in Massachusetts is reimagining education. Brandeis University recently announced its plan to reinvent the liberal arts. The blueprint offers new academic structures, curricula, degree programs, teaching methods, and career education. To learn more, Lucas Willard spoke with Brandeis University President Arthur Levine.
We're seeing profound changes in demographics, economics, technology, globalization, and now politics. And what it means is that, well, what's going to mean is that 20 to 25% of all college, every college is going to feel this, 20 to 25% are going to close. Community colleges and regional universities are increasingly going to move to online formats. And it's very, very important in this new world of profound change that we have programs that will prepare students for the world they're really going to face. There's this incredible quote from Henry Adams. So the guy, his grandfather, father, they were all presidents. And he was a journalist, and he was a historian. And he went to Harvard in the mid-19th century. And he claimed he received an 18th century education for a world plunging into the 20th century. He received an education that was 200 years behind the times. That's the challenge, and that's the opportunity that every college in America is facing now.
So, President Levine, this past week, as we're speaking right now, you unveiled the Brandeis plan to reinvent the liberal arts. And what immediately stuck out for me when taking a look at just sort of the cheat sheet with some of the details about this plan is that career preparation is a primary focus, not just you know, you're going to learn your take your history class and take your language credit and take your science laboratory class. And there's a career counselor who's available on campus. That seems to be very much the old way of doing things. This is a career in every single step of a student's education. So can you tell me a little bit more about what that integration is actually going to look like in classrooms?
Sure. First, another quick history lesson.
Sure.
What I'd say is this. The liberal arts have always been practical. And people went to medieval universities and they studied the ancient trivium and quadrivium. Why would you do that? Because if you did it, you got a great job in the church. So they form a university in Cambridge in 1640s, and they're going to offer a curriculum to these people who have the natives are not all that happy with them. The climate's awful. They don't know much about agriculture. So what's this new college going to teach? Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and Syriac. What percent of the local tribes do you think spoke Greek? The reality is nobody spoke Greek. Why would anybody study this curriculum? The reason is they want you to be leaders in the colonies. And this is what you needed to know to be able to do it. So that higher education, liberal arts have always been practical, and they've shifted over time to accommodate the needs of the society and the needs of, and the state of knowledge. So when we talk about careers, we're only making it explicit. We're not doing anything the liberal arts hadn't done historically. And I guess the reason for talking about careers is the liberal arts are most successful, which, to paraphrase Jane Addams, the social reformer, when they have one foot in the library, which is the accumulated knowledge of humanity, and one foot in the street. Well, when the world changes fast, we lose traction with the street, and we need to restore it. And that's why the emphasis is so heavy on careers.
So when it comes to classroom teaching and looking at the curriculums that are included in this plan, how, if you were applying, if I was applying to Brandeis and I was about to enroll in classes, how might classroom education look different at Brandeis? And maybe it's not exactly always apparent on the surface and what the teacher is saying, but how that curriculum was developed behind the scenes as part of this new reinvention. Yeah.
And you'd see three things that are different. Thing number one is we've reorganized the entire faculty so that we've mixed the liberal arts and their applications. So instead of studying business, you'd study economics in business. Instead of studying social science, you'd study social science and social policy. Science, engineering and technology. Humanities, arts, culture. But so you'd find really practical things in your liberal arts education. In addition, what you'd find are you'd have a career advisor the day you arrive on campus, as well as an academic advisor. You'd have experiential education and internships in which you apply the liberal arts to the real world. And finally, you'd get a new transcript, a second transcript, which would record all the career-aligned competencies that you've achieved while in college that can be sent to employers. It can be sent to graduate schools, professional schools. You have a record of what you know and you can do. And you'll have another transcript, which gives the courses and the grades you got. And one more thing. You know, every school has general education. It's this long list of courses. Take one here, one there, one. And we said, you know, what would be far better is if we focused on the skills and knowledge you need to live in this world, this emerging world. So let's revise the whole curriculum. And on top of that, let's make it competency-based. So what it means is we'll be teaching students the life skills they need. We'll be teaching them about critical thinking. We'll be teaching them about communication. We'll be teaching them about cooperative work and we'll be teaching about all the things they need in their lives of a general nature.
And speaking of emerging technology, I want to ask about AI and artificial intelligence, which it seems to be everybody's talking about these days, especially how it relates to education. There's on one hand the possibilities of this technology, and then on the other hand, there's the warnings of the do not do this, do not do that with this technology. But how is Brandeis embracing AI in its instruction moving forward?
Yeah, we're building a lab. The internships, the advising, the second transcript is all under the Center for Applied Liberal Arts and Careers. There's one other piece. It's a lab. What we want to do is we want to work on applying AI, virtual reality as well, to pedagogy in order to prepare students for the world that they're going to enter. So that's critical. You asked about, God, what do you do with AI? Should we, is it a menace? Is this going to destroy all of higher education? Or is this some boon, some wonderful thing? It's definitely not a menace. The greatest opportunity it offers us, it's out of the box now. We can't put it back in the box. It's going to dominate our society and our culture. The question is, how do we use it constructively? And we need to figure out what the guardrails are going to be. But we also need to use it in ways that can really enhance learning for students. And if you look at AI, I saw a debate recently between two principles in the French Revolution. Real people. What they'd done was reconstructed the things they thought and turned it into a debate between these two people. Education's going to be a lot like that. Virtual reality is going to make it possible not only to lecture about 5th century Athens, we can take people there. In a few years, we'll be able to smell the smells, which had to be putrid. There was no sewer system. But they'll be able to talk to people. They'll be able to walk the grounds. They'll be able to see 5th century Athens. What more could you ask? These are incredible learning tools. We just have to figure out how to use them and not be afraid of them.
Arthur Levine is the Brandeis University president. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Lucas Willard. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1823. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to Lucas Willard. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, WAMC.org. Until next time, I'm Madeline Reynolds.